damage to U.S.-Russian and U.S.-Chinese relations that had begun under Obama would not be easily undone. Overall, Obama's legacy is a mixed one. He was clearly a disappointment to the progressive backers who held such high hopes for him in the country when he defeated John McCain in 2008. While repudiating the worst aspects of the neoconservative hyper-militarism of the George W. Bush presidency, he never wavered in his support of American empire, or broke as definitively as needed with Bush's policies. On June 6, 2013, former Bush Press Secretary Ari Fleischer told CNN's Anderson Cooper, "Across the board, when you look at what he's done, he's continued so many of the Bush administration policies, from drone strikes to military commissions to wiretaps to renditions to, you name it, he's doing it. It's like George Bush is having his fourth term. And I praise President Obama for it. Now, I think he's a hypocrite. He campaigned against President Bush, and it was a violation of the Constitution to do these things. But I think he's learned." Fleischer may have felt vindicated by Obama's policies, but American progressives felt betrayed. Perhaps the most egregious of all the betrayals came in Obama's failure to substantially reduce the risk of nuclear war, or even the size of America's nuclear arsenal. He had thrilled the world in June 2009 with his Prague pledge to eliminate nuclear weapons, even winning the world's greatest honor, the Nobel Peace Prize, largely in response to that promise. Given Obama's long-held and apparently sincere opposition to nuclear weapons, dating at least back to his undergraduate days at Columbia in the early 1980s, the world anticipated some major progress in nuclear weapons reduction. Not only did people not see progress, the anti-nuclear movement lost ground under Obama. In 2010, the United States and Russia negotiated the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, widely known as New START, which limited each nation to 1,550 strategic nuclear warheads as of February 2018. But because bombers are counted as single warheads, regardless of the number of bombs they carry, the actual number of warheads is around 2,000. The U.S. and Russia also have thousands of warheads in storage. In order to secure congressional approval of the New START Treaty, Obama made a soul-selling compromise, a devil's bargain, with pro-nuclear lobbyists and their Republican allies. When Senate Majority Whip John Kyle, Republican from Arizona, threatened to kill the New START Treaty, Obama caved to his demands for a sweeping modernization of America's nuclear arsenal and delivery systems, its bombers, missiles, and submarines, a massive project estimated initially to cost $1 trillion over 3 decades. The Congressional Budget Office raised that estimate to $1.2 trillion in October 2017. The true cost, with anticipated inflation, will certainly be significantly higher, more in the $1.7 trillion range. But cost is the least of the problems. The modernization will make the weapons more accurate, more deadly, and, in the minds of many nuclear war planners, more usable. Reuters explained the changes succinctly. The United States under Obama transformed its main hydrogen bomb into a guided smart weapon, made its submarine-launched nuclear missile 5 times more accurate, and gave its land-based missiles so many added features that the Air Force in 2012 described them as basically new. To deliver these more lethal weapons, military contractors are building fleets of new heavy bombers and submarines. While limiting the number of warheads and launch vehicles, the treaty lets each side determine design of delivery methods. Thus, Reuters noted, both sides are increasing exponentially the killing power of these weapons, upgrading the delivery vehicles so that they are bigger, more accurate, and equipped with dangerous new features. In the authoritative Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, 3 leading nuclear experts argued that improved targeting capability had tripled the killing power of U.S. ballistic missiles, laying the basis for a successful first strike. One of the keys to the modernization effort is the B-6112 Smart nuclear bomb, with a steerable tail fin kit that greatly improves accuracy. These new bombs, the most expensive ever built, costing almost twice their weight in gold, can be made frighteningly powerful. They can also be made quite small. In fact, they have four variable yields, one of which is strategic and three of which are tactical. The smallest is only 0.3 kiloton, a tiny fraction of the 16 kiloton bomb with which the U.S. leveled Hiroshima. The most powerful is 340 kilotons, or more than 21 times the infamous Little Boy bomb. The fear is that the smaller detonation, precisely targetable mini-nukes, will be much more usable than bombs hundreds or thousands of times more powerful. The new B-61-12s are slated to replace the 150 to 200 tactical nuclear weapons the U.S. has in five European countries: Germany, Holland, Belgium, Italy, and Turkey. The bombs, which no longer serve a military purpose, offer an inviting target for terrorists. Russia condemned the European upgrade as a provocative threat that eroded the strategic balance, and retaliated for that decision and for the partial deployment of a missile shield in Romania in 2016 by deploying Iskander-M nuclear-capable missiles to Kaliningrad, the Russian enclave bordering Poland and Lithuania. While the initial deployment was temporary, Russia redeployed missiles on a more permanent basis in early 2018, in response to the broader NATO buildup in the region. While the hopes of those who had long dreamed of a world without nuclear weapons were crushed by Obama's reversals, pro-nuclear forces were ecstatic. In 2015, Alabama Congressman Mike Rogers addressed a weapons conference sponsored by Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, and General Dynamics. "I think we can safely say the president's Prague vision is dead," he gloated, "and I'll leave it to the Nobel Committee to ask for its prize back." In May 2016, Hiroshima survivor Setsuko Thurlow, who delivered one of the two Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speeches in 2017, in recognition of her lifelong efforts to abolish nuclear weapons, expressed her disappointment with Obama's lack of meaningful action. "The world waited and waited and waited, but so far our problem continues and it's actually worse. So we are, and I am, very disappointed. It's a huge, huge disappointment for the world." Administration insiders were often as disappointed with Obama's capitulation to the hardliners as were his outside critics. Former Undersecretary of State for Arms Control Ellen Tasha reported, "A universal sense of frustration and disillusionment among those who entered the administration expecting to limit nuclear weaponry." In May 2016, with Obama en route to Hiroshima, the Federation of American Scientists, FAS, reported that he had actually reduced the nuclear arsenal at a slower pace than had either of the Bushes or Bill Clinton, his three post-Cold War predecessors. At that point, with a few more months of his presidency still to go, the U.S. had dismantled 702 warheads, or 13.3% of the arsenal. Clinton, by comparison, had reduced the arsenal by approximately 23%, George H.W. Bush by 41%, and George W. Bush by 50%. Hans Christensen, the FAS analyst, noted that the fault was not entirely Obama's, given the fierce opposition in Congress and a Russian government that had resisted additional reductions while New START was being implemented. Christensen did, however, note that during the time of the Obama presidency, Russia had reduced its stockpile by more than 1,000 warheads. Like so much of Obama's nuclear policy, his visit to Hiroshima was commendable and regrettable at the same time. Hiroshima, the city that the United States had chosen as the target for its first combat use of an atomic bomb, had a symbolic significance that no other city possessed. No sitting president had ever visited. Jimmy Carter had done so after his presidency. The world was waiting to see what message Obama would convey. Some in Hiroshima, including many hibakusha, bomb-affected people, demanded an apology, but most felt that the visit itself would suffice. The White House had made clear from the start that no apology would be forthcoming. Given the rawness of public sensibilities about the still contentious bombings after more than 70 years, this was not surprising. However, The administration also made clear that serious discussion of nuclear history was likewise off the table. Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes announced that Obama will not revisit the decision to use the atomic bomb at the end of World War II. In fact, the visit sent the wrong message from start to finish. First, Obama spent more time with U.S. and Japanese troops at Iwakuni Military Base than he did in Hiroshima. When he finally got to Hiroshima, he made a brief 10-minute visit to the Peace Memorial Museum, before heading to the cenotaph in Peace Memorial Park to deliver his remarks. Following his remarks, he shook hands with the two hibakusha who had been deliberately seated in the front row. The first, Mr. Tsuboi, had gone out of his way to state that no apology was needed, expected, or desired. The second, Mr. Mori, whom Obama embraced, had spent years apologizing to Americans for the U.S. POWs who were killed by angry Japanese after the bomb was dropped. Obama carefully avoided the other less forgiving hibakusha guests, who were strategically seated out of reach. More damningly, Obama's visit gave a boost to Japan's bellicose, U.S.-affirming and history-denying Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, in advance of his upcoming re-election bid. Abe's re-election was crucial to Obama's slow-moving Asia pivot. It was also crucial to the continuing effort to abolish Article 9 and further erode Japan's peace constitution in the name of Japanese remilitarization. But most troubling was the content of Obama's speech, which struck a false note from start to finish. In his opening sentence, he stated, 71 years ago, on a bright cloudless morning, death fell from the sky and the world was changed. Clearly, death did not just fall from the sky. The United States dropped an atomic bomb on the overwhelmingly civilian population of that ill-fated city, instantly killing scores of thousands. Two sentences later, Obama asked why we come to Hiroshima, and again, deferring blame and speaking in passive voice, responded, "To ponder a terrible force unleashed in a not-so-distant past." He later referred to the moment the bomb fell. In fact, nowhere in his speech did he mention that the United States dropped the bomb. He did say correctly that we have a shared responsibility to look directly into the eye of history and ask what we must do differently to curb such suffering again. And not only did he not look directly into the eye of history, he repeated the most dangerous myth about the atomic bombings, the one that allows them to be justified by so many misguided Americans, which we explored in depth earlier in this volume. He said the war reached its brutal end in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Nothing could be farther from the truth. The bombings did not end the war. The Soviet invasion forced Japan to surrender, just as Allied intelligence had been predicting for months that it would. As the National Museum of the U.S. Navy in Washington, D.C. now openly admits, the vast destruction wreaked by the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the loss of 135,000 people made little impact on the Japanese military. However, the Soviet invasion of Manchuria on 9 August, fulfilling a promise at the Yalta Conference in February, changed their minds. Obama looked at history in the eye and blinked. He assured his audience that what makes our species unique is our ability to learn from and not repeat the mistakes of the past. We can tell our children a different story, he declared, one that describes a common humanity, one that makes war less likely and cruelty less easily accepted. Like so much of the Obama presidency, this speech was filled with high-minded sentiments and poetic imagery. But like so much of Obama's 8 years in office, the reality left much to be desired. Nothing rang more false and hollow than his hypocritical call for nuclear abolition at a time when he was committing the country to decades of modernization that would make nuclear weapons more, not less, usable. We may not realize this goal of a nuclear-free world in my lifetime, he granted, failing to state the obvious. As president, he could have striven mightily to realize that goal as Mikhail Gorbachev had done. But he lacked the vision and courage to make that happen. He will be remembered as a decent, well-intentioned man, a man who lent dignity to the highest office in ways that no one had since Jack Kennedy, but a man who snatched mediocrity from the jaws of greatness, and whose failures helped open the door for Donald Trump, who did everything he could to destroy what Obama had achieved. Some were cheered, though, when word leaked out that Obama wanted to disavow America's long-standing nuclear first-use policy. In a New York Times op-ed in August 2016, General James Cartwright and Bruce Blair, a former Minuteman launch officer, urged Obama to take that step, writing, "Nuclear weapons today no longer serve any purpose beyond deterring the first use of such weapons by our adversaries. Our non-nuclear strength, including economic and diplomatic power, our alliances, our conventional and cyber weaponry, and our technological advances, constitute a global military juggernaut unmatched in history." They cited a recent public opinion poll showing that only 18% of Americans countenanced first use under any circumstances, with 67% responding that the U.S. should either never use nuclear weapons or should do so only in retaliation for a nuclear attack on the United States. Opposition to adopting no first use came from Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter, Secretary of State John Kerry, and Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz. The three top aides argued that adoption of this policy would signal weakness to American allies and adversaries at a time when Russia and China were both acting in an aggressive and belligerent manner. They feared that Japan and South Korea would be rattled by the move, especially in light of Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's campaign statements questioning extension of the nuclear umbrella to those Asian allies. Cartwright and Blair also joined other nuclear experts in urging Obama to begin eliminating all the land-based ICBMs still housed in silos across the Midwest, which were not only extremely costly, but were dangerously vulnerable to an enemy attack. Obama declined to act on first use, nor did he offer to Russia a 5-year extension of the New START treaty, which would have committed incoming administrations to abide by treaty limitations beyond its 2021 expiration date. Thus, Obama handed off to Donald Trump a $1 trillion-plus nuclear weapons and delivery systems modernization program, a first-use policy, vulnerable land-based ICBMs, an arsenal large enough to end virtually all life on the planet, and dangerous conflicts on several continents that could develop into nuclear confrontations. Trump wasted little time in making all of them worse. Trump's cavalier and precedent-defying approach to nuclear weapons was visible throughout the campaign. Unlike previous presidents, he said he would accept nuclear proliferation, thinking South Korea, Japan, and Saudi Arabia might be better off with their own nuclear arsenals, so they would no longer depend upon the United States. This was part of his stated goal of cutting back on U.S. military support for wealthy client states. He has questioned the point of having nuclear weapons if the U.S. can't use them, in a bid not to eliminate them, but to make them more usable. A frighteningly revealing moment came while Trump was campaigning in Evansville, Indiana. Former basketball coach and Indiana icon Bobby Knight endorsed Trump, comparing him to Harry Truman. "I'll tell you who they said wasn't presidential. Harry Truman. And Harry Truman, with what he did in dropping and having the guts to drop the bomb in 1944, saved millions of American lives. And that's what Harry Truman did. And he became one of the three great presidents of the United States. Here's a man who would do the same thing, because he's going to become one of the four great presidents of the United States." Trump gushed. "Such a great guy. Wow. How do you top that? You should be very proud of him in Indiana. This is a national treasure, okay?" Among those who might have indirectly influenced Trump's thinking on nuclear weapons were his billionaire backers Robert Mercer, the conservative hedge fund manager, and his daughter Rebecca. The Mercers have championed some of the most odious members of the Trump administration: Steve Bannon, Kellyanne Conway, Michael Flynn, and Jeff Sessions, helped found Cambridge Analytica, and funded the alt-right Breitbart News, as well as the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine, run by biochemist Arthur Robinson, who believes human urine holds the key to extending life and has collected 14,000 urine samples that he keeps refrigerated on his farm. Robinson has inveighed against climate change, calling it a false religion. And in 1998, organized a deceptive petition claiming support of 30,000 scientists who rejected the Kyoto Protocol and cast doubt upon man-made climate change. Upon closer examination, the 30,000 included many falsified signatures and few, if any, bona fide climate scientists. Robinson convinced Mercer that nuclear war would not be as bad as advertised. In fact, he argued, outside the immediate blast zone, radiation would have a beneficial effect on human evolution. An insane theory that conservative physicist Edward Teller had espoused several decades earlier. In 1986, Robinson wrote a book arguing that the vast majority of Americans would survive an all-out atomic attack on the United States. Experts had long known that the opposite is true. The latest peer-reviewed scientific studies of nuclear winter show that Carl Sagan and his collaborators, who made the public aware of the environmental effects of nuclear war in the 1980s, did not exaggerate the threat to human survival. They underestimated it. The threshold for nuclear annihilation may be significantly lower than previously believed. Sagan and colleagues calculated the effects that the burning of cities in a nuclear war would have on the environment. They found that the resulting dust, smoke, and soot would block the sun's rays from reaching the Earth and produce a nuclear winter that would drastically lower temperatures on the Earth's surface, destroying agriculture and potentially ending life on the planet. Sagan published a popularized account in Parade magazine. He warned readers, "Some of what I am about to describe is horrifying. I know, because it horrifies me." Controversy erupted. Edward Teller led the counterattack. The public was deeply alarmed. Sagan and his colleagues published their study in the prestigious Science magazine, along with another one by leading biologists that concluded, "In any large-scale nuclear exchange between the superpowers, global environmental changes sufficient to cause the extinction of a major fraction of the plant and animal species on Earth are likely. In that event, the possibility of the extinction of Homo sapiens cannot be excluded." Sagan followed up in the Council of Foreign Relations, Foreign Affairs, where he wrote, "We have, by slow and imperceptible steps, been constructing a doomsday machine. Until recently, and then only by accident, no one even noticed." Soviet scientists and government officials agreed and joined the call to sharply reduce nuclear arsenals. But others, especially vociferous backers of the Strategic Defense Initiative, such as Richard Perle, mobilized to discredit the science behind nuclear winter. Despite growing scientific consensus that the risk was real, deniers of nuclear winter cast enough doubt to forestall action. A study published in 1986 by the Council on Foreign Relations contended that the TTAPS study had exaggerated the effects, and the worst-case scenario was nuclear fall, not nuclear winter. The Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and Time concurred. In 1987, William F. Buckley's National Review declared nuclear winter a fraud. Discover magazine in 2000 dismissed nuclear winter as one of the 20 greatest scientific blunders in history. But Alan Robach, Brian Toon, Richard Turco, Georgi Stenchikov, and others would not be silenced. Recent state-of-the-art computer modeling shows that the danger from burning cities is far greater than scientists understood in the 1980s. Their studies indicate that a limited nuclear war between India and Pakistan, countries that have fought four wars and always seemed poised for another, in which 100 Hiroshima-sized nuclear weapons were detonated, could release more than 5 million tons of black carbon, smoke, and soot into the stratosphere. In less than 2 weeks, it would encircle the Earth, where it would remain for more than a decade, blocking the sun's rays and driving temperatures so low that much of the agriculture would stop. This would cause a 20 to 40% decrease in global food production over the next 5 years, leading to the deaths of up to 2 billion people. As horrible as that would be, it pales compared to the danger of all-out nuclear war fought between the superpowers, with arsenals consisting of thousands of nuclear weapons, most between 7 and 80 times as powerful as the bomb used in Hiroshima. Robach, Toon, and their supporters made efforts to ensure that those with access to the nuclear codes understood the stakes. They tried for years to reach top officials in the Obama administration, but had no success. Though frustrated, they persisted, and finally got meetings with John Holdren, Obama's senior advisor on science and technology, and Under Secretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, Rose Gottmuller, both of whom expressed skepticism about nuclear winter. One wonders how aware Trump is of nuclear winter, and what his true feelings are about nuclear weapons use. His comments about nuclear weapons over the years have been a mix of concern and bravado. In November 1984, at the height of the 1980 nuclear winter debate, Lois Romano wrote somewhat mockingly in a Washington Post profile of Trump, "This morning, Trump has a new idea. He wants to talk about the threat of nuclear war. He wants to talk about how the United States should negotiate with the Soviets. He wants to be the negotiator." The always humble Trump assured Romano that he knew exactly how to do it. "It would take an hour and a half to learn everything there is to learn about missiles. I think I know most of it anyway." During the campaign, Trump disavowed nuclear weapons use, but insisted the U.S. needed to be prepared for all contingencies. He sounded more strident a month before taking office, tweeting, "The United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capability until such time as the world comes to its senses regarding nukes." In an attempt to clarify this statement, the president-elect told MSNBC's Mika Brzezinski, "Let it be an arms race. We will outmatch them at every pass and outlast them all." He made the point again, explaining to Reuters, "It would be wonderful. A dream would be that no country would have nukes, but if countries are going to have nukes, we're going to be at the top of the pack." In February 2017, Reuters reported on a shocking phone call between Presidents Trump and Putin, the first between them since Trump became president, in which Putin brought up the possibility of extending the New START treaty beyond its 2021 expiration date. Trump had to pause the conversation to ask his aides what the treaty was. Once informed, he strongly criticized it and rejected its extension. He complained to Reuters, "It's a one-sided deal like all the other deals we make. It gave them things that we should never have allowed. Our country only made bad deals. We don't make good deals." By a vote of 71-26, the Senate had approved this bad, one-sided treaty, which had the unanimous support of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and was endorsed by 7 four-star admirals and generals who had controlled all U.S. strategic nuclear forces. Fearing what Trump might do with nuclear weapons, many agreed with Hillary Clinton when she said during the campaign, "A man who can be provoked by a tweet should not be anywhere near the nuclear codes." Massachusetts Senator Edward Markey and California Representative Ted Lieu introduced legislation in January 2017 to prevent the president from launching a first strike without Congress declaring war. Lieu explained the need to restore checks and balances and exercise congressional restraint over nuclear weapons. "It is a frightening reality that the U.S. now has a commander-in-chief who has demonstrated ignorance of the nuclear triad, stated his desire to be unpredictable with nuclear weapons, and as president-elect, was making sweeping statements about U.S. nuclear policy over Twitter." Markey reminded the public that Trump has threatened to use nuclear weapons to punish terrorists. Trump's comments and behavior exacerbated fears about his nuclear recklessness. His bemoaning the decline in the U.S. arsenal and calling for a tenfold increase during a July 20th meeting led Secretary of State Tillerson to call him a fucking moron. Even stalwart conservative George Will took issue with Trump's incontinent tweeting, rhetorical taunts, and other evidence of the frivolity and instability of the 13th president of the nuclear era, warning that his almost daily descents from the previous day's unprecedentedly bad behavior are prompting urgent thinking about the constitutional allocation of war responsibilities, and especially about authority to use nuclear weapons. Will derided the simplicity of Trump's thinking about nuclear warfare. "Trump's foreign policy thinking. In the old days, when you won a war, you won a war. You kept the country. We should bum the shit out of the Islamic State. Is short on nuance, but of Metternichian subtlety compared with his thoughts on nuclear matters. On February 2, 2018, the Trump administration released the Pentagon's Nuclear Posture Review, NPR, the country's first since 2010. Whereas Obama's 2010 review had reduced the role of nuclear weapons in the U.S. defense posture, the 2018 review elevated that role and proposed active measures to counter perceived new threats. The review focused on the heightened threats posed by Russia and, to a lesser extent, China, which Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis had recently elevated above terrorism as the primary threats to U.S. national security. American war planners fixated on Russia's escalate-to-de-escalate doctrine that envisioned using lower-yield nuclear weapons early in such a conflict to force negotiations on Moscow's terms, and proposed increasing the U.S. arsenal of smaller nuclear weapons. Also alarming was the review's permitting the use of nuclear weapons to respond to vaguely defined extreme circumstances, or non-nuclear strategic attacks like cyber attacks, or attacks on infrastructure such as the power grid or cell phone networks. The U.S. would defend not only its own vital interests against non-nuclear attacks, but also those of its allies and partners. Critics immediately countered that the U.S. was dangerously escalating the nuclear arms race. Obama's Assistant Defense Secretary Andrew Weber thought the new plan absurd. "We're simply mirroring the reckless Russian doctrine," he observed. "We can already deter any strike. We have plenty of low-yield weapons. The new plan is a fiction, created to justify the making of new nuclear arms. They'll just increase the potential for their use and for miscalculation." The administration's logic is Kafkaesque. Perhaps the strongest critique came from Russia itself. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs said it was deeply disappointed that the U.S. Nuclear Posture Review was so confrontational and anti-Russian. It denied that Russia had lowered the threshold for first use, and feared that U.S. justification for using nuclear weapons in dangerously ambiguous, extreme circumstances opened the door to potentially indiscriminate use, as did U.S. plans to build new lower-yield warheads. Russia claimed to have reduced tactical nuclear weapons by 75%, and to have removed the rest from delivery vehicles, while the U.S. is modernizing its tactical nuclear weapons in Europe and deploying them near Russia's borders. Those who followed the preparation of the NPR were not surprised by its belligerent tone. It was written by a team of nuclear strategists led by former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Keith Payne. Payne, president of the National Institute for Public Policy, had a well-deserved reputation as a nuclear hawk. In 1980, he co-authored a blood-curdling article in Foreign Policy, insisting the U.S. could win a nuclear war against the Soviet Union, and with adequate command and control, keep U.S. losses down to a survivable 20 million people. While some argue that the NPR that Payne helped craft is generally in line with those of other recent presidents, others, including top military brass, pushed back against Trump's empowerment of nuclear hawks as both dangerously provocative and exorbitantly expensive. One senior nuclear analyst told the American Conservative, "The story you won't hear is how this really came about, and here's how it happened." One day, Sean Hannity got on television and talked about how we need more nuclear weapons, and Donald Trump heard this and went over to the Pentagon. And presto, we got Keith Payne and his crew. That's the truth, and that's what got us to where we are. Nuclear weapons were only part of the story of America's revitalized militarism. In March 2018, Trump signed the $1.3 trillion omnibus spending bill. It contained a record $700 billion for the military, which Trump ludicrously claimed had been very depleted, despite his major infusion of new funds the year before. Trump had actually requested $716 billion for fiscal 2019, a 10% increase over FY 2018 levels. Some of that increase went to the new weapons Trump and the Pentagon sought. A substantial portion went to paying for U.S. Special Operations Forces, which deployed to 149 nations, or 75% of the countries on the planet in 2017, up from the staggering 138 Obama had sent them to the year before. Trump has also broken Obama's record levels of overseas arms sales. Equally disturbing were Trump's plans for outer space, which, like cyber, has become a new realm of military confrontation. In June 2018, Trump called upon the Defense Department and Pentagon to create a new Space Force as an independent sixth branch of the armed forces. "It is not enough to have an American presence in space. We must have American dominance in space," Trump declared, adding that he did not want to see China and other countries leading us. A Defense Department official commented revealingly, "Space is a warfighting domain, so it is vital that our military maintains its dominance and competitive advantage." Trump had put Vice President Pence in charge of a reconstituted National Space Council. In August, Pence reaffirmed Trump's vision before an audience at the Pentagon. "The time has come," he declared, "to write the next great chapter in the history of our armed forces, to prepare for the next battlefield." He falsely claimed that the U.S. was simply responding to Russian and Chinese initiatives. "Our adversaries have transformed space into a warfighting domain already, and the United States will not shrink from this challenge." Chris Johnson, the space law advisor for Secure World, a nonprofit dedicated to the peaceful use of space, in Vienna that week for the 50th anniversary of the UN Conference on the Exploration and Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, worried about the lack of rules for military conflict in space. "In the space domain, we don't know what the rules are. Literally, we do not have any conventions or rules for conflict in space." He saw the creation of Trump's Space Force as very escalatory and quite threatening. Other nations will look at it and go, "Oh, I need that too," making conflict in space more likely. Professor Carl Grossman, author of The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, understood that what the Americans started, the Russians and Chinese would have to match despite the cost. "They're not going to sit for it," he insisted. "They're going to get up there before you know it. It will all be nuclear. It's the ultimate nightmare." Grossman, who has been writing about weaponization of space for decades, spelled out the recklessness of Trump's plans, which involve laser beams, particle beams, and hypervelocity guns, all of which will have to involve nuclear power. "If there's a shooting war, it will be Chernobyl and Fukushima in the sky. Some of it will come down, which will be catastrophic, and some will take millennia to fall, which means the heavens are going to be littered with radioactive debris." Of all the many, many terrible things the Trump administration is doing, opening space to war will be the most destructive. Despite Trump's manifest willingness to feed the voracious appetite of the military-industrial complex, including defense contractors, it clamored for more. In November 2018, the National Defense Strategy Commission, a hand-picked 12-member congressionally appointed bipartisan body, conjured up its most frightening modern-day version of bomber gaps, missile gaps, witches on broomsticks, Mongol hordes over the horizon, and a nation in dire risk absent a significant boost in military spending. Congress tasked the commission with reviewing the Pentagon's January 2018 National Defense Strategy, which had sharply elevated the threat status of Russia and China. But that was not enough for commission co-chairs Eric Edelman, a former Undersecretary of Defense under George W. Bush, and a top aide to Vice President Dick Cheney, and retired Admiral Gary Ruffhead, a former Chief of Naval Operations, or members like former acting CIA Director Mike Morrell. In the best sky-is-falling tradition of the 1957 Gator Report, this report began, "The security and well-being of the United States are at greater risk today than at any time in decades. America's military superiority has eroded to a dangerous degree. America's ability to defend its allies, its partners, and its own vital interests is increasingly in doubt. If the nation does not act promptly to remedy these circumstances, the consequences will be grave." The United States' failure to keep pace in military technology has made Russia and China more assertive in their quest for regional hegemony, increasing the likelihood of war, a war in which U.S. victory was not guaranteed. While the Americans have been coasting, allowing the Budget Control Act of 2011 to cap military spending, Russia and China have been on the march, though Russia has managed to substantially upgrade its military capability when controlling and now cutting its defense spending. The threats posed by Iran and North Korea have also worsened. Hence, the U.S. must stick with the vast nuclear modernization program outlined in the February Nuclear Posture Review. The U.S. military, it cautioned, could suffer unacceptably high casualties and loss of major capital assets in its next conflict. It might struggle to win or perhaps lose a war against China or Russia. The United States is particularly at risk of being overwhelmed should its military be forced to fight on two or more fronts simultaneously. The report's executive summary concluded on an equally somber note. The costs of failing to meet America's crisis of national defense will not be measured in abstract concepts like international stability and global order. They will be measured in American lives, American treasure, and American security and prosperity lost. It will be a tragedy of unforeseeable but perhaps tremendous magnitude if the United States allows its national interests and national security to be compromised through an unwillingness or inability to make hard choices and necessary investments. The report recommended increasing the military budget 3 to 5% a year above inflation. This could be achieved in part by cutting social services, because mandatory entitlement programs drive spending growth. Such programs include Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. As a result, the authors admitted, such adjustments will undoubtedly be quite painful, but it's a pain Americans will have to bear. As dismal as Trump's track record has been overall, he has recognized the need to ease tensions between the world's two leading nuclear-armed nations. Amid all the uproar over Russian intrusion in the U.S. election, the Russian and American presidents met in Helsinki in July 2018. Critics howled when the two met privately, accompanied only by translators, to seek common ground on some of the salient issues challenging humanity. They were convinced that the skilled and well-informed Putin would have his way with the ill-prepared and impulsive U.S. president. Trump's statements at the subsequent press conference, indicating that he trusted Putin's denials about election meddling over the findings of U.S. intelligence agencies, produced even greater astonishment and triggered charges of treason. Trump was forced to walk back several of his statements. The near-universal condemnation and widespread desire to criticize Trump for anything and everything he said and did blinded many to the overriding importance of improving relations between the nuclear superpowers. Lost in the uproar was the fact that there was important precedent for such private meetings. In fact, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev met alone for 4 hours and 51 minutes in Geneva in November 1985. They had their differences over such issues as Afghanistan and missile defense, but established a rapport that would lay the foundation for later progress on nuclear arms and other issues, and dramatically reduce tensions between the Cold War antagonists. According to Reagan's press secretary, Larry Speaks, Reagan told Gorbachev, "There is much that divides us, but I believe the world breathes easier because we are here talking together. Our differences are serious, but so is our commitment to improving understanding." The Speaks later acknowledged having fabricated this and other statements he attributed to the president. The statement was as valid then as it is today. Were reversals in other areas also possible for the mercurial Donald Trump? No area needed action more desperately than climate change. A 2018 study in the journal Nature revealed that Antarctica, which held between 60 and 90% of the world's fresh water in its ice sheets, was melting 3 times as fast as it had just a decade earlier. Scientists predicted that this melting, resulting largely from greenhouse gas emissions, would cause sea levels to rise 6 inches by 2100. These conditions, combined with record temperatures, were producing 1,000-year weather events, in the form of hurricanes, droughts, floods, and wildfires, on an annual basis. A paper published in Nature in December 2017 found that actual conditions were sharply outpacing predictive models, and that it was possible that temperatures would increase globally by 5 degrees centigrade by 2100. Scientific consensus was that anything above a 2 degree, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit rise would have catastrophic consequences. But in 2014, the World Bank reported that present emission trends put the world plausibly on a path toward a 4 degree centigrade, 7.2 degree Fahrenheit rise by the end of the century. Nathaniel Rich of the New York Times alarmingly described the horrors that such changes would portend. The world has warmed more than 1 degree Celsius since the Industrial Revolution. The Paris Climate Agreement, the non-binding, unenforceable, and already unheated treaty signed on Earth Day in 2016, hoped to restrict warming to 2 degrees. The odds of succeeding, according to a recent study based on current emissions trends, are 1 in 20. If, by some miracle, we are able to limit warming to 2 degrees, we will only have to negotiate the extinction of the world's tropic reefs, sea level rise of several meters, and the abandonment of the Persian Gulf. The climate scientist James Hansen has called 2-degree warming a prescription for long-term disaster. Long-term disaster is now the best-case scenario. 3-degree warming is a prescription for short-term disaster. Forests in the Arctic and the loss of most coastal cities. Robert Watson, a former director of the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, has argued that 3-degree warming is the realistic minimum. 4 degrees. Europe in permanent drought. Vast areas of China, India, and Bangladesh claimed by desert. Polynesia swallowed by the sea. The Colorado River thinned to a trickle. The American Southwest largely uninhabitable. The prospect of a 5-degree warming has prompted some of the world's leading climate scientists to warn of the end of human civilization. The Trump administration's abysmal record on environmental issues has only made things worse. Trump's first EPA head, Scott Pruitt, who denied evolution itself in 2005, became the administration's poster boy for climate change denial and environmental degradation, until he was forced to resign in July 2018 under a cloud of ethics scandal so vast that it staggers the imagination. But he was not alone. From Trump, who had once dismissed man-made climate change as a hoax created by and for the Chinese, on down, administration flat earthers expressed hostility not only to climate science, but to science in general. Trump was the first president to not have named a science advisor a year and a half into his presidency, since the position was created in 1941. Neither the state nor agricultural departments had appointed science advisors, though science was crucial to both departments' missions. The Interior Department and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration went so far as to disband their science advisory committees. The Food and Drug Administration had done likewise with its Food Advisory Committee. Pruitt purged his agency's board of scientific counselors, dismissing members who wanted to take action to slow climate change. Finding it impossible to work in such a hostile environment, scientists were fleeing the federal government in droves. Princeton professor of geosciences and international affairs, Michael Oppenheimer, critically observed, "I don't think there's ever been a time in the post-World War II period where issues as important as nuclear weapons are on the table, and there is no serious scientist there to help the president through the thicket. This reverberates throughout policy." In April 2018, more than 1,000 members of the National Academy of Sciences blasted Trump's decision to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord, calling attention to the dangers of human-induced climate change, which were already causing suffering and economic loss that would only get worse in the future. They decried the administration's denigration of scientific expertise and harassment of scientists. The New York Times angrily accused administration officials of waging a war on science and conducting a government-wide purge of people, particularly scientists, whose research and conclusions about the human contribution to climate change do not support the administration's agenda. And several agencies even banned the words climate change from their reports and websites, replacing them 1984-style with words like weather extremes. The military and intelligence communities, however, were taking climate change seriously. The 2018 National Defense Authorization Act contained a provision declaring climate change a direct threat to the national security of the United States. Section 355 focused on vulnerable military installations, noting that rising sea levels could threaten more than 128 United States military sites, including a $1 billion Air Force radar installation projected to be underwater within 2 decades. Among the other potential at-risk sites were military bases in Norfolk, Virginia and Florida, as well as Diego Garcia, Guam and Bahrain. Most appalling was the campaign to spread disinformation about climate change by some of the same people who had lied so egregiously about nuclear winter. In the forefront of the effort was the Heartland Institute, which had been founded in 1984 and was initially generously funded by such leading polluters as the Koch brothers and Exxon. In 2017, it began sending copies of its book, Why Scientists Disagree About Global Warming, and an accompanying 10-minute DVD to the country's more than 200,000 K-12 science teachers. Ann Reed, executive director for the National Center for Science Education, NCSE, told PBS's Frontline, which ran an expose of the climate change-denying propaganda group, "It's not science, but it's dressed up to look like science. It's clearly intended to confuse teachers." The Center for Public Integrity discovered a national network of organizations funded by the oil and gas industry, promoting the benefits of fossil fuels to America's schoolchildren. Not surprisingly, Oklahoma under State Attorney General and unabashed corporate shill Scott Pruitt was in the forefront of such efforts. According to a 2016 survey published in Science, about 10% of science teachers nationally had been teaching that humans played no important role in climate change. 31% taught that the issue was still being debated, while more than half taught that humans were definitely the primary cause. Though there is a special place in hell for people who would desecrate the earth in order to fatten their own wallets and feed corporate greed, right alongside the places reserved for war profiteers and nuclear war planners, the efforts of the climate deniers are doomed to fail. Psychiatrist Robert J. Lifton, who has written so presciently about the nuclear threat over the years, observed in 2014 that Americans appear to be undergoing a significant psychological shift in relation to global warming, which he labeled a climate swerve, a major historical change in consciousness. Lifton cited a recent Yale survey that concluded that American certainty about global warming was increasing, and that those who doubted that fact were becoming less convinced that they were correct. He drew an important parallel. Responding to the climate threat, in contrast to the nuclear threat, whose immediate and grotesque destructiveness was recorded in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, has been inhibited by the difficulty of imagining catastrophic future events. But climate-related disasters and intense media images are hitting us now, and providing partial models for a devastating climate future. Among those who had taken notice was Pope Francis. In June 2018, he told fossil fuel executives meeting to mark the 3rd anniversary of Laudato Si, his inspired 184-page encyclical on global warming and environmental degradation, that the slow pace of transition to renewable fuels was disturbing and a cause for real concern. He particularly condemned oil and gas companies' continued search for new fossil fuel reserves. Bill McKibben calculated that meeting the Paris targets would require leaving more than 80% of known fossil fuel reserves in the ground. In introducing his 2015 encyclical, subtitled On Care for Our Common Home, the Pope wrote, "More than 50 years ago, with the world teetering on the brink of nuclear crisis, Pope St. John 23 wrote an encyclical, which not only rejected war, but offered a proposal for peace. He addressed his message, Pacem in Terris, to the entire Catholic world, and indeed, to all men and women of goodwill. Now, faced as we are with global environmental deterioration, I wish to address every person living on this planet. In his farewell address, 34 years earlier, Jimmy Carter had similarly connected the nuclear threat to the fate of a planet in peril. Frustrated by Senate failure to ratify the Sol II Treaty, Carter had fought inspiration from astronomer Carl Sagan, whose 13-part documentary series Cosmos had just broken public television viewing records, and whose warnings about nuclear winter would soon spark a global debate. In words written by Sagan, who understood better than anyone the challenge facing humanity, Carter said, "Nuclear weapons are an expression of one side of our humanity. But there's another side. The same rocket technology that delivers nuclear warheads has also taken us peacefully into space. From that perspective, we see Earth as it really is. A small and fragile and beautiful blue globe. The only home we have. We see no barriers of race or religion or country. We see the essential unity of our species and our planet. And with faith and common sense, that bright vision will ultimately prevail." Sagan's optimism in 1981 seems sadly out of place today. 120 years after the Spanish-American War and the bloody Philippine intervention thrust America into the global race for conquest and empire. At the time, William Jennings Bryan and others warned that the nation would lose its soul if it chose imperial folly over republicanism. Centuries of slavery, Native American genocide, worker exploitation, and misogyny had already taken their toll, but redemption still seemed within reach. The nation was young. Immigrants flooded its shores, bringing new energy and dreams. It had a bright future. Potential greatness lay ahead. But it chose a different path. The United States turned into an industrial and military behemoth, the likes of which the world has never seen. But it paid a heavy price for that domination. The nation that was once an example to fledgling democracies around the world has now become a model of dysfunction, in which money dictates and buys elections, lobbyists write legislation, infrastructure crumbles, the gap between rich and poor grows at an astounding rate. The three richest Americans now have as much wealth as the bottom half of the population, paralleling the obscene fact that globally, the richest eight people have more wealth than the poorest 3.6 billion. Minority voters face disenfranchisement. Candidates with fewer votes than their opponents repeatedly win elections. Millions go without health care and other basic services. Surveillance suffocates and inhibits. Waste and pollution destroy the environment. Bigotry pervades and demeans. Schoolchildren get massacred over and over again. Opioids abound. The shared public space shrinks. And schools fail to educate. Donald Trump might epitomize and expedite that decline, but it certainly antedated his presidency. Some aspects can be traced back to the 1890s, others to Woodrow Wilson, others to the tragic decision to anoint Henry Luce's American century instead of Henry Wallace's century of the common man. The U.S. plunged deeper into the abyss with the atomic bombings and start of the Cold War. And then George W. Bush and the neocons delivered the coup de grace. Trump, for all his ugliness, buffoonery, and neo-fascist dog whistling, is more of a continuation than a departure. Although his maverick nature and the fact that he is not beholden to the foreign policy establishment might bring some surprises, both good and bad. The end of the Cold War should have given humanity a chance to step back, take stock, and go forth in a new direction. But the wisdom and vision to do so were lacking. Nowhere did a true American statesman, a Henry Wallace, a John F. Kennedy, a Martin Luther King, step forward. and nowhere did the masses display the fortitude and wisdom that Karl Marx had anticipated, and take the lead in reorganizing the world. Hence, the 21st century has not been kind to the inhabitants of our planet, despite the remarkable economic strides made by China and other nations to lift millions from extreme poverty. There have certainly been recent glimmers of hope. The global effort to stop the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the bombing of Syria in 2013 were prominent examples. The nuclear weapons ban treaty at the UN and the award of the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize to ICAN was another, as were the anti-base movements in Okinawa, South Korea, and other nations, which have persisted against tremendous odds. The Occupy movement spread rapidly and raised profound concerns about the gap between rich and poor. The remarkable leadership of the students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, in rekindling the national effort to promote sensible gun laws was another still. The Black Lives Matter and Me Too movements have brought awareness to deeply rooted problems in American society. Struggles for racial, sexual, and gender equality have won important victories along the way, as have efforts to combat global warming, ban nuclear weapons, win higher wages and benefits for working people, redistribute wealth, halt rape and violence against women, and defend health care and immigrant rights. But we're in a race against the forces of entropy and destruction that are also gaining momentum. Paraphrasing Unitarian minister and abolitionist Theodore Parker, Martin Luther King Jr. observed, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." We no longer have the luxury of a long arc. We must bend it faster. As bleak as things might seem, despair is an attitude we can't afford. Taking the broad view of history, and using a conceptual device that Carl Sagan popularized in his award-winning book, The Dragons of Eden, telescoping the history of our universe into one 365-day calendar affords a different perspective. From this vantage point, the Big Bang, which occurred 13.8 billion years ago, is placed at 12 a.m. on January 1st. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, had its start 11 billion years ago on March 16th. The Earth was formed 4.54 billion years ago on September 6th. Life on Earth began 4.1 billion years ago on September 14th. And human beings finally made their entrance on December 31st, the last day of the year, at 10:30 p.m. Columbus's discovery of America didn't occur until December 31st at 11:59 and 59 seconds. Thus, in cosmic time, human existence has been incredibly brief. In a sense, we just learned to walk upright a minute and a half ago. In our fleeting moment on this stage, our species has created works of extraordinary beauty and grandeur. Yet in that short time, we have also developed the means to end life on our planet. It can certainly be said that our technological proficiency far exceeds our moral, social, and political development. Therefore, our real task, as a species, in the period ahead, is to survive our own worst and most destructive tendencies. To neither kill ourselves off with nuclear bombs, nor destroy the Earth we collectively inhabit. Certainly we must struggle with all our might for peace and social justice. Those of us who have learned the lessons of history and can envision a fundamentally different and more humane way of organizing society, one that would allow people to live fuller, more prosperous and peaceful lives, have a special responsibility to make our voices heard. But if that better world is not to be for our generation, we must at least sustain the possibility that future generations, perhaps 100, perhaps 1,000, perhaps 10,000 years from now, will have the opportunity of realizing our unfulfilled dreams. At the start of this journey, when we began the documentary film and book project, we dedicated it to our 6 children, biological, adopted, and step, of Asian, African, and European ancestry, and the better world that they and all children deserve. We end on the same note, affirming our faith in our often misguided, sometimes destructive, and occasionally exalted species, to someday achieve that goal. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Untold History of the United States by Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick. Performed by Peter Burkrot. Directed by Karen Lund. Performance copyright 2019 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number. 1-800-222-3225. Or visit our website at www.brilliancepublishing.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.